chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I am delighted to have Mike Arrieta on the show today. Mike is the CEO of Garden City Equity and co-founder and board member of New Story. Well, Michael, welcome to the Something Extra podcast. I have really been looking forward to this time with you. You and I met several years ago at a CEO forum event at the Broadmoor. And then I kind of lost track of you. And then our dear mutual friend, Steve Gattina, in February said, Lisa, you need to meet Michael. And Michael, you need to meet Lisa. And Lisa, you need to have him on the podcast. And I'm like, I know Michael. I've met Michael before. So I love it when those connections happen like that, you know? So it was awesome to get reconnected with you.
Well, absolutely. Same exact here. All that I remember is that you were a much better axe throwing contender than I was over there at the Broadmoor.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know how well your memory's working for you today. But anyway, we had fun nevertheless. So I don't want to embarrass you, but I did go and just look at what people have said about you. And I just remember what I remember about you, Michael, is you talking about what you were doing and what you had done. And I just remember sitting there and literally, to God be the glory, but I was so impressed. I'm like, look at this young man. He has done so much in his short life here compared to where I am. And I was just really impressed with you. So I don't want to embarrass you, but I'm going to go through here and just read what people have said about you. Okay. So, you know, this is not video. I mean, this is video, but we won't show the video. So you can blush if you need to. But here are some of the things that people have said about you. You're a hard worker, you're passionate, you're highly motivated, you recognize the importance of both family and faith, you're brilliant, you're articulate, you want success not just for yourself, but you want success for others. You're strategic, innovative, servant leader, humbly walks the talk, seeks to understand, great business executive, tremendous leader, People talk work-life balance, but you take it to the whole new level by leading by example. You're authentic. You're one-of-a-kind leader. And here's what one person said. They said, simply said, everyone needs a mic in their life. And so I am thrilled today to give our listeners just a little bit of Michael. And
I'm super curious where you got this poll from. I'm like, wow, that's very impressive. I've been on a lot of podcasts and I've never, man, that is good, Lisa. That is really, really good.
Well, that's what other people have said about you. And so, yeah, I'll send you that list. And, you know, we need to do daily affirmations for ourselves, right? You can just every morning get up and read that list. I love that. But that very last line simply said, everyone needs a Michael. And so that's what I'm hoping today to do, Mike, is give our listeners a little Michael today. But right. To take me Take me back. I'd love to know a little bit about how you grew up, and then we've got all kinds of things to talk about.
Sure. I grew up in South Florida. I was born in Miami, grew up a little bit north of there in the Fort Lauderdale, Coral Springs area. Very, very, very hardworking, lower income family. Father, he was in furniture his whole life, selling furniture. He started by delivering furniture, and then his peak was just selling furniture. He and my mom never made more than $40,000 as a combined household income in 1 year. They're very hardworking. They tried their best. No one in my family ever went to college. And the two things that they are most proud of is the three of their children all graduated from college, and the three of their children are now have strong faith, and they got baptized, which to them was very important. And it was just awesome. So really hardworking family, but financially was really difficult on us. Ever since I was young, I've always had a little entrepreneurial bent to me. I've always been a little bit of a troublemaker, always a little disobedient, always wanted to push the rules a little bit and bend them to see how much I could get away with. I was in high school when my father got really sick. He went into a coma and had a pancreas transplant, a kidney transplant, amputation. My mom also got breast cancer right around that same time. And I started selling Cutco cutlery, Cutco knives. Not really door to door, but basically through my immediate network of my other friends in high school. And then I would use their parents to refer me to 10 other people. And then I would now start to build a little bit of a web, a little bit of a network. So I did that as a junior in high school, became the number one salesperson in Cutco for several years in a row in the world, competing with like 50,000 other people selling knives. That allowed me to pay for college and help my family financially, graduate debt-free, all that good stuff. And so that was my upbringing, a little crazy, a little hard at times. We moved 15 times in 18 years. I had a bad stutter problem. So there was a lot of difficulty, I would say, but my parents did the best they could, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, and they gave you a firm foundation, you know, on which to stand on too, Michael, and with your faith. And, you know, I did read that story about you, that you did start selling cocoa to help your family financially, and because your dad had become ill. And so I, no pun intended, but I said you cut your teeth on being an entrepreneur businessman by selling Cutco, no pun intended. But I can't not even tell you how many successful people I know that started with Cutco.
Wow.
So many successful people, probably people that you would know. John Rulin is one that comes to mind that did extremely well with Cutco. But it taught you a lot, didn't it? And I was telling Jenny, I'm like, if you don't have Cutco knives, you need some Cutco knives.
Send me her address. That's one of my guilty pleasures, is dropping people a couple knives.
Yeah, it is. I'm telling you, people, listeners, go get you some Cutco knives. We've got, you know, we've got the larger knives, we've got the steak knives, and they last forever. I mean, they are just, it's a fantastic product. But you learned so much, Michael, from doing that. You know, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but what are some of the things that you learned? You know, and you've already referred to one, and that is you got really good at referrals.
Yeah. That's huge. I mean, huge, huge. I mean, referrals is critical. I would probably the biggest thing I learned selling Cutco was the importance of building a rapport with people, which building rapport then automatically builds trust with people. And then once there's trust developed, now there's easy to figure out and form a partnership or transaction, you know? So that was a huge thing. I learned how to ask for the sale. So now running a private equity fund, people know when I'm fundraising. If we're having a meeting, I'm very much asking them to invest. I'm not scared to say, hey, I'll send you an investment deck and you can just take a look at it or anything like that. You know, it's very much, I'm not scared to ask for the sale because it's a product that I deeply, deeply believe in. That was Cutco, or that's, you know, now fast forward 20 years. Asking for the sale, objection handling. I really got comfortable with objection handling, knowing that, you know, it takes an average 3 to 5 no's to get a yes. at least that was in the Cutco consumer B2C world. Thankfully, it doesn't take three to 5,000 now what I'm doing. I don't know if I can handle it at this point in my life. But yeah, so objection handling was another one. And referrals was critical. It's funny that you brought that up. It's something that I see that's such a benefit in our businesses today. I just had a phone call with one of our CEOs today, and we lost a big account. And what I encouraged her with is I said, Sherry, she's the leader of one of our companies. I said, Sherry, we have so many other accounts that they love us. Have we ever considered going to them and asking for referrals? She's like, no, we haven't. I said, if we've been serving them faithfully for a good time, we're providing good service, that's our best go-to-market approach there is. And I did the same thing with my team at DocuSign. I was at DocuSign for a while. Mm-hmm. I did the same thing there where no one in enterprise B2B software sales obviously has a referral component to enterprise sales. And we did. So that was another component I learned at Cutco.
I absolutely love that. And, you know, Greg and I run an information technology firm, staffing and solutions. And I will tell you, anytime that we attract someone to our company, Michael, that's what we say, find us your twin. And I will tell you, both from a business development as well as a talent supply, referrals have always been our number one go-to market strategy. If you have a happy customer, you know, going to them and saying, who else do you know might could benefit from our services? I mean, it's, you know, but sometimes we just don't ask. I think follow-up and asking for that is really critical. And I don't care what business you're in. So, but, you know, going back to Cutco, I mean, by the time you were 17 years old, you were making a six-figure income. And I know you went to the University of Alabama. I think that's right, right? Yeah. You went to the University of Alabama. But after college, Michael, you had the opportunity to go to Silicon Valley, but it was a difficult decision for you. And I was thinking about this, and there could be other people that this would really resonate with, because you were already making a six-figure salary and you're like, do I go on and take a chance on something else, maybe making half of that, or do I continue on with Cutco? And I was just thinking, sometimes we need to take a step back.
Almost, right? Yeah.
For a promise of a greater tomorrow, or opportunity in the future. Tell me about that process. Who did you lean into to help you make that decision? Because that was a tough decision. Yeah. It wasn't like you were making minimum wage.
Yes.
You were making good money.
Yes. No, absolutely. I think a couple of things came to mind. One is something I realized as I continued to do Cutco. I mean, every summer in college, I would go to New York City and sell Cutco in the wealthiest zip code in the country. It's an area in New Jersey in Bergen County. And I just remember being like, I don't want to be the one that is on this side of the table selling, you know, a couple thousand dollar set of knives. I want to be the party on the other side of the table that has the ability to buy multiple set of knives and have that control power and have that buying power. And I just realized that being on that side, it kind of goes back to the joke. I forgot how it goes, but Shaquille O'Neal or Chris Rock joke or something. That's like, no, the man that signs the check, right? Like, oh, you think Shaquille O'Neal's a big deal? It's the man that signs Shaquille O'Neal's check. So that always stuck with me in terms of saying, I will never be on that side of the table by being the one that sells Cutco knives. And so that's the God honest truth that I had, that deep clarity that I realized, okay, making 150, 200K a year in college is incredible. And going to Silicon Valley and taking a job of a 21-year-old kid, I'm going to make 75, 85 grand. And that's a half a pay cut, literally, right? It's more than a 50% pay cut. But I just realized that I have to take one or two steps backwards to take 5 or 10 forward. Every single step I've ever taken my whole career has been exactly that. Every single step I've taken some backwards to take some forward. So it's the whole entrepreneur dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But there could be listeners out there that's like, you know, ooh, do I give up a bird in the hand, you know, for two in a bush? And maybe you do, you know, but I think that needs to be each individual's decision. I mean, we can't tell people what to do on that, but you kind of have to wrestle with it yourself.
I probably get a weekly phone call or weekly text or a LinkedIn message, something to that extent. And the first thing I tell them is, Being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. It is not for everyone. It takes a lot of sacrifice. It takes a lot of decision making. It takes a lot of hours. You have to have a deep conviction. And me, as a follower of Christ, it all comes down to, do I feel that this is something that God has in my calling, right? Is this something that he has uniquely called me for? And what I encourage people is, if you do feel the calling to be an entrepreneur and you do feel the calling that this is what the Lord is calling you to, then you have to be willing to make that sacrifice. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't be working at a gentleman I just spoke to. You can't be working at Medtronic making $500,000 a year and saying, but I really feel a conviction that I'm supposed to start something small and lead people and create something for my community and bless people and later have a lasting enterprise while making $500K a year right now. Like, it just does not exist, you know?
Right.
And so it's, are you willing to follow that conviction and follow that calling, but also being obedient on having a little bit of a sacrifice?
Yeah. 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 I would say that too. You know, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you need to go all in and you need to make that decision. You know, it can't be halfway. Well, okay. So you went to Wise. Is it Wise or Wheezy?
Oh, Wise.
Wise. You went to Wise, which was a startup, right? And then had an event happen after 18 months, which was really cool. You guys ended up selling to Dell and you became the chief of staff. And I think that that was 2011. Wow. I mean, Michael, I've known people that have been chief of staffs. I mean, that is like an MBA on steroids, isn't it? Why do you think?
Very well put. Yep.
Yeah. Why do you believe that being a COS, you know, could be such a critical step in someone's career trajectory?
Because of what you just said, I think it's a real life MBA every single day. Every single day. So every single day, you are basically a mini CEO. A CEO is looking at a 360-degree view of the organization. They're 1 inch deep, but a mile wide. So they're having to make sure that the finances and the margin are there. They're having to make sure that the branding go-to-market is there. They're having to make sure the partnerships are there. They're having to make sure that, you know, your hiring plan's on board, that your leadership team is being developed, that your product is coming to market on time. And with the certain features and functionalities, I mean, all of it. And a wise CEO, I believe, especially at a hyper growth company, is realizing that they can't be the strategic person while being the actual integrator and being the person that is focusing on tactically and accomplishing all of their details, like emails, or meeting follow-ups, or tactical planning for conferences, or whatever it is. And so if you get that opportunity to be a chief of staff, it's better than an MBA. You're literally a mini CEO.
Yes.
And the thing about the chief of staff role is, the way I see it, there's different varieties and different flavors of it. And I was part of a chief of staff cohort that I think it was the Washington Post did an article on like this little secret society of Silicon Valley chief of staffs. And it's a wide gamut. I mean, we had a chief of staff in there, and I don't have to mention to whose name, but a very probable CEO's chief of staff. They were basically a glorified EA, right? So they were just there for logistics and calendar and making sure that there's preparation for meetings. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you had people that were quite literally an extension of the CEO. They would step into meetings the CEO couldn't be in. They would be a strategic advisor. They would be a jack of all trades. They would be the person that the management team goes to when the CEO is not available. And so I was privileged enough that my CEO allowed me to be the latter. And what he told me in the beginning is, you have a voice, but you don't have a vote, right? And that was so important to know that where I stood. I'm like, okay, I have a voice. I can put it in my perspective, but at the end of the day, I'm not on the C-suite. So that was really important for me. I loved it. I got a full exposure to it. And then when I had more conviction that I wanted to own a P&L, I was talking to one of my mentors, actually, that's Pat Gelsinger, part of the CEO forum. And I was talking to Pat one morning, and Pat's like, Michael, you need P&L experience. It's great to be a chief of staff, but you need to be 1 inch wide now and a mile deep. And I think both are really helpful.
I did not know that Pat was one of your mentors, Michael. What an amazing man, right? And he's now what, the CEO for Intel? Is that correct? Yeah. So it, just an incredible person. You've had amazing people in your life. In 2014, you went to DocuSign. We've already talked about that just a little bit, but you went there as the COS for Keith Croc. And I did a little bit of research on Keith. My goodness, Michael, I did not know this about him before, but he's got a very impressive background. He co-founded Ariba, which I tell you, most every Fortune 500 company is using for their procurement and supply chain. We
Correct.
have a lot of our companies that use Ariba for that. Former VP of General Motors, chairman of the board for Angie's List. He has a Harvard MBA. I looked at Glassdoor. He had a 97% approval rating as the CEO. So an incredible leader. So a lot of people, Michael, might say, how did you get to be so lucky, Michael, to work for such amazing leaders and such amazing brands? And tell me, what's your definition of luck? Because you and I subscribe to the same definition, I think.
It's funny you talk about luck right this second. The story about DocuSign was completely what most would call luck. I think what luck is when preparation meets opportunity,
Yes.
right? I really do believe that. The story about DocuSign is quite literally, if I had a luck story, it would be that. It was our company Wise sold to Dell. I'm now working at Dell. We had a monetary transaction because they obviously bought the company. And there was a wake-up moment. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I was at a small company. I was getting paid a salary. And I had this extra thing called shares, not knowing if they would ever equate to something. Now I'm working at Dell. There are no more shares, but I'm still getting salary. I was like, so clearly the hustle, the hack in business, especially in Silicon Valley, is you get a good salary and then you have additional shares that could be monetized at some point. And so one of our board members at Wise, he was on the board at DocuSign, and he was saying, hey, Keith Kroc is looking for a new chief of staff. And so I tried to get in to see him. Probably six times he canceled on me. He was just so busy scaling the startup, so busy. And then finally, one meeting he did not cancel. So I walk into his office. You know, it's a 30-minute meeting. He's really busy. And he's like, tell me about your story. So it's only about Cutco, you know? And he was like, I want to rip up your resume right now and throw it in the air. He was like, if someone could sell Cutco the way you did, they could do anything. And he was like, so you're telling me that you are the chief of staff to the CEO of Dell Software? I was like, yes, sir. And he was like, are you okay if I, as part of this interview process, I'm gonna have to vet this out. You're a young guy. You're like 23, 24 years old. And I was like, well, actually, crazy enough, he's based in Austin, Texas, but tonight he's actually having an event here in San Francisco. He goes, where at? I say, St. Regis. He goes, I've lived at the St. Regis. This is amazing. He goes, look, how about this? How about you come? I'm gonna have a dinner with someone. It's one of our DocuSign angel investors. I'm gonna have a dinner. Pull me out of that dinner at 8. You'll take me to meet your CEO at 8:15. I said, done. I walk into that dinner. He's having dinner with the gentleman we just spoke about, Pat Gelsinger. Pat Gelsinger has been my mentor for years. Pat goes, what are you doing here? Do we have a meeting? Do we blah, blah, blah? And Keith goes, wait, how do you guys know each other? Pat was the CEO of VMware at the time. And I said, no, I'm actually talking to Keith Kroc. And he's like, I'm an investor in DocuSign. And it was this total serendipitous, total luck. I obviously call it of the Lord, you know? And that was the story. It was like on the perfect day after canceling on me six times, the perfect night of that party at the St. Regis, the perfect dinner with my mentor, you know? I mean, so incredible.
Incredible. Incredible. I absolutely love that story. Well, you know what? We have got so much more to talk about, Michael, but we do need to take a quick break and then we'll be right back on the Something Extra podcast with Michael Arrieta.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
So, Michael, we were just talking about the definition of luck, and I subscribe to that very same definition. You said it's when preparation meets opportunity. And clearly, you had all these opportunities that were coming to you. I don't know that they would have come to you, though, if you had not have done the preparation that you needed. And, you know, many times I think sometimes, you know, opportunities come, and if we have not done the work, we'll either miss it or we're just not the right fit at the time. But how do you personally believe that along the way you were preparing yourself, Michael?
I've always been authentically curious about everything. So people at Cutco to back up there, they would always be like, man, you build the best rapport with people. Like, how do you do it? And I didn't realize that it was just, I'm authentically curious. So I would walk into your house and I'd say, how long have you lived here? Oh, how do you find the neighborhood? Oh, where did you and your husband meet? Oh, that's great. And then where was your first job? How old are your kids? How do you choose their names? Where do you guys go on vacation? How do you build your, and I would just keep going. And then we would look at a 1 hour appointment for Cutco. We'd be literally 45 minutes in. And the last 10 minutes would be, here's what I do. And they'd be like, I don't care what you do. I'm in, you know, I am in. And if you take that same exact authentically curious mentality to talking about, for example, the luck at DocuSign. Well, we had board members at Wise, and I was the chief of staff to the CEO, and I would just authentically be curious of building a relationship with them. I was thinking about this recently. Why the heck, at such a young age, did these high-level CEOs and venture capitalists take time? I mean, it's with a 20-something-year-old. But then I remember I was just truly authentically curious at learning, and I would just ask them when I saw them in the office, hey, is there any way we can meet for coffee? I'll drive to your office before you get there, or maybe we can meet for a glass of wine or anything like that whatsoever. And there would be no ask other than just sitting at their feet, other than just wanting good counsel and discernment and wisdom. And what it created was just friendships and trust, as I mentioned again. And so that's when that board member knew that Keith Kroc was looking for a chief of staff and so forth. Right. And then when I get those opportunities, I prepare like a maniac. Right. Yes. And so when I knew that I was going to meet Keith Kroc, I would watch every single YouTube video ever created on him. And I would read every single thing on at Harvard and Angie's List and Ariba and Purdue University and all these things. And so I would know his mentality. So I would just be overly prepared, and I wouldn't be fake. I would be authentic, but I would still be prepared, you know?
Right. Oh, I think that is so good. There's so much wisdom in what you just said, because, you know, I feel like, especially if you're going into like from a mentee to a mentor type scenario, Michael, you owe it to that mentor to be prepared.
Yeah,
the onus really needs to be on the mentee. And I just know, look, in our own company, because over 29 years, we've hired a lot of people. And it's the people that express the desire to grow and to learn, and they're like a sponge. Those are the people you want to invest in.
Completely.
And I bet you even Pat Gelsinger, you know, Michael, he saw something in you that possibly even reminded him of himself when he was younger. And you do, you just want to, people that are excited, you know, about what you're doing. I mean, those are the people you want to invest in for sure. So I just, I love that. I love that. And I know that you've said, you know, you were a hard worker. You were first in the office and first, you know, last out, you know, first in, last out, you know, not to use an accounting term, but, you know, so tell me real quickly about DocuSign, because I know when you came there, Michael, there were 150 people. And when you left, there were 6,000 people. DocuSign has been a game changer. We use DocuSign. I love it. I can be anywhere in the world and review a contract, sign that contract. I mean, it is a game changer. And I know Keith had said, and I love this, he said he wanted the term DocuSign to mean a verb.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a vision. We wanted it to be the Kleenex. We wanted it to be the Q-tip. We wanted it to be the Google it. And I think that we achieved that. I mean, I know in our board meetings now, I'll constantly hear operators say, hey, we just got to roll out DocuSign. Like we need something to electronically sign stuff. And they don't even necessarily mean that company, but they just mean that process, that functionality of electronic signature. So that was a goal. Our whole concept of DocuSign was a couple strategies. One was, let's create a new market. And if you create a new market and you're the only one in that market, by default, you are the market leader. Right. So we said, let's not talk about electronic signature. That market's very, very overcrowded. Let's just call it digital transaction management. We're going to help companies manage their digital transactions. It just so happens our product to do that is electronic signature. And if we're the only ones in the DTM, digital transaction management space, we are the global leader in DTM. So that was a very, very big strategy, because then RFPs get written around you, and then Gartner and Forrester and everyone is doing that, and they come to you as a subject matter expert. So that was critical. Another critical strategy for us was integrating our equity financing fundraising strategy to our corporate go-to-market strategy, which was critical. So what that meant was, we said it does not make sense that every time we have to go raise money as a venture-backed company, we start off with Kleiner, Sequoia, Andreessen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to go to the traditional VCs to start. We're actually going to go to the strategic institutional investors that they've set up a corp dev arm that has a VC arm. So Microsoft Ventures, Salesforce Ventures, Google Ventures, SAP Ventures, T-Mobile, Samsung, FedEx, the list goes on and on. So we would go to them and say, hey, we're a Silicon Valley company. Here's our growth. Here's what we do. And do you want to actually invest your dollars into this for potential return? And if you do, we're going to set up a multi-pronged strategy. And what that multi-pronged strategy is you're going to resell us. You're going to buy us as a customer. You're going to integrate us into your product, and you're allowed to invest in our company. So that was something that really, really allowed us to achieve escape velocity.
Kind of set you apart.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And that's really, you know, not to fast forward to what I'm doing now, but that was my entire thinking going into it, is let's use very, very strategic, multifaceted dollars rather than passive dollars. And that gives us the competitive edge. So,
So cool. Such a great success story. I don't even know what the market cap is for, you know, but I know that DocuSign's trading on the NASDAQ now, and probably 10 billion plus company. I don't know. But, you know, before we go into Garden City and what you're doing today, I really want you to tell our listeners a little bit about News Story. And this was kind of funny. You know, you founded, I think you co-founded with a couple of other people and your best friend. In 2016, you were recognized, Michael, in Forbes as 30 under 30 for social impact because of what you have done with News Story. And it's funny because I just had Sean Lambert on the show. And Sean, if you know Sean, was the founder of Homes of Hope. And afterwards, Steve Gattina says to me, hey, Lisa, you're going to want to meet Brett Hagler. And then I'm like going, no, wait a minute, Brett Hagler. I think Brett is Michael's best friend that he, the world just keeps getting smaller and smaller to me. But anyway, I thought that was funny because I said, Steve, you know, Michael's coming on the podcast. And so I know that you guys, your goal was to impact 1 million people by 2030 by eradicating homelessness from the planet. But tell us about that journey. I think you guys may have gone to Haiti and, you know, got inspired.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Brett Hagler and I, we grew up together in Coral Springs Christian Academy. When we were in sixth grade, we became close best friends. We were chasing all the things of the world, unfortunately, for many years. He called me in 2013 and he said, hey, I just started going to church and I got baptized. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay, cool, dude. Like, that's great. That's good for you. And he's like, and now I want to spend the rest of my life just serving others, impacting others, and making a difference. I was like, wow, that's awesome. Like, who can't get behind that? And so he said, do you want to go with me on a mission trip to Haiti? I was like, yeah, of course, I'll go with you on a mission trip to Haiti. And so we went, and we were just blown away that it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, utterly blown away. And what we realized was there was a lot of nonprofits focused on Maslow's hierarchy of needs around water. There was a lot of organizations focused on water. There's a lot of organizations focused on food. But there was not really state-of-the-art, next-generation nonprofits focused on housing. And a friend of ours, Scott Harrison, the founder of Charity Water, Scott was focusing on a very innovative model around water, clean water, where 100% of all dollars received would go directly to the cause, would go directly to the field. And then they would have this innovative model where a small group of investors would fund all of their overhead, aka their back office and administrative offices. And then there would be total transparency. So you would see the family that you're donating to. You would see how much money it takes to build a house, and you would actually see video proof of that family moving into that home. So total transparency instead of a black box. And we started seeing how much it would cost to build homes. And people would say $40,000, $50,000. Like in Haiti, $40,000 or $50,000 to build, you know, a 600 square foot home. And what we realized was it was just not efficient. It was not streamlined in any manner at all. So we said, why don't we go ahead and try to solve this homelessness problem across the world by creating a charity water for homes? That was the true genesis that people will. And then we realized by talking to the contractors on the ground that really it would only cost about $6,000 per each home that we built. So for $6,000, you could literally build a brand new home for a family. And one shelter comes in, then everything else comes in. I mean, education is easier, entrepreneurship is easier, healthcare is easier, literacy, all of it, right? All of it becomes so much easier once you have a home, right? You've been, I'm sure something's happened in your life that you've had to move out of your house, or you didn't have a house for a season. It's hard. It's difficult. Imagine not having a home. And so we started a new story, I believe in 2017, or I forgot what year, or 2014, maybe in 2014. And we just started that. And then we went through Y Combinator. And then we just kept growing. And now we exceed about $20 million a year. We've impacted tens of thousands of people. And now we're building full communities. So think about it as like suburbs in third world countries in very rural areas of Mexico, El Salvador, Haiti, and other places.
Well, this is what I really would love for you to talk about. You've got that 1 million people that you want to impact by 2030. And, you know, a friend of mine this last weekend, Michael, gave me the book 10X is Easier Than 2X. And I was thinking about you and thinking about, you know, something that helped you 10X what you guys are doing. And you're using technology. I was so like blown away by how you're using 3D printing and that to make it more efficient to build the house. So you don't need as much money. Your dollars can go further, right? And instead of $50,000 for one home, you know, $50,000 can build eight homes.
Build 10, or 10 homes. Exactly.
Yeah. So tell me about that technology, what you guys are doing. Is there something else on the horizon?
Yeah, there's technology is about half of our team. So half of our team are developers. And really where the 3D printing idea came in that Apple did a documentary on us on is all around the fact that Brett Hagler, it was really all of his genesis. Brett Hagler realized, he said, every year we're building thousands of homes, but one hurricane or one something come in and it could wipe out, you know, 1,000 homes in a day. He said, so the problem is this massive, think about it as a massive field. The problem is this massive field. And every year we're just, there's a couple, we're just making such a little impact of the global problem. So he said, the only way to truly eradicate homelessness in our short lifetime is we need to get the cost half of what it already is. And we need to have the building be half of what it already is. So we were applauding ourselves being $6,000 to $8,000 a home, takes 30 days to build a home. That's amazing. Brett's saying we need to do it in 10 days to build a home, and it needs to be $2,000 to $3,000. And the only way we could realize to do that is through robotics and through automation. And so we partnered with these guys that wanted to get a company off the ground called Icon. They were not a company at the time. And we gave them a seven-figure check to get that company off the ground. And we said, we will be your first customer. I know this is a crazy idea, but if this works, it could impact a lot of people. So we're about to start our second 3D printing community here shortly. And we believe that the technology is very new still, but we believe that that could be the game changer in the next decade.
It's going to help you 100X what you're doing, Michael. I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, in March of 2020, you founded Garden City. So I'd love for you to tell our listeners, what is it? And I know you guys are very, you've got a different model. You've got a buy and hold model. It's not like you're buying companies and then looking to flip them or turn them around and flip them. What do you want to accomplish with it? You know, who's your target audience to, and are there brands that we would recognize? And if you've got any anecdotal stories, and I know that's a lot, but I know that we're getting short on time, but I do want you to tell us all about Garden City.
Sure, sure. Yes. So the story with Garden City, the founding story is when DocuSign went public, my wife and I went on sabbatical and we asked each other, if money were no object and we were only going to live 10 more years, what is it that we would do with the rest of our days? And we're kind of extreme thinkers like that. And I said, I know the answer. I've always known the answer. I would buy up all these small to mid-sized, founder-owned, family-owned service businesses. And I would buy them. I would ask the owner to stay or to go. I would want to support them in whichever way that they feel called to. So totally flexible. We'd buy it with no debt at all. I hate debt. So we'd buy it with no debt, only cash, only equity. And we would have a long-term horizon. So we would never buy and flip them. And that's what I would do. And I would buy janitorial businesses, IT companies, white accounting firms, white collar, blue collar, whatever it is. We would just buy these great, great, great local community-like companies from the owners that are thinking about their succession plan, about what to do, because they know that they're not going to live forever and run it forever. And that's it. And kind of a baby Berkshire Hathaway of small businesses. And our purpose behind that would be that we want to honor God by creating environments where all workers could thrive and prosper and flourish. So we want to buy companies and just be obsessed with the humanity aspect. Of be like, it's all about people. It's all about people. It's all about people. We want to go above and beyond for our people. We actually never even talk, like, I never even talk about customers. Everyone talks about going above and beyond for the customer. I think if you just go radically obsessed with your people, they'll take care of the customer. And so that was the vision. I started sharing it with a couple of my long-term mentors. And to my surprise, they were like, hey, if you take some of your capital to go buy some of these great businesses that are throwing off millions of dollars of free cash flow per year, I'd love for you to take my capital alongside yours and buy these great companies. And then another person said it. And then I'm like, what do I do when a lot of people are offering to give me their money to buy companies alongside me? And that's when someone told me, dude, that's a private equity fund.
Yeah.
And so I had no clue what a private equity fund was. I was never in finance or anything like that at all. And so I said, I guess we'll try to raise a little bit of money, maybe 10 million bucks. And then 10 came in. I was like, I guess we'll do 20 and then 20 and then 30. And then we, in our docs, we were able to raise money until February of 2020. And so by the time that that time came, we raised about $50 million from about 50 mission aligned, values aligned, and value add investors. And so the list of people that are our shareholders is just phenomenal, right? They're just such amazing leaders and athletes and investors. And so that's it. So that was the vision. So it's create a mini Berkshire Hathaway that's focused on creating jobs where people could thrive, prosper, and flourish. And we're just, if everyone else in private equity is like a bird, we are like a giraffe. We are just utterly different.
Yeah. Yes, I love it. And I love you, you know, mentioning Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, because, and we don't have time to get into it, but I know that they've got the 90-day process and you guys subscribe to that. It's not like, you know, years, you know, that you're doing the vetting. I mean, it's a pretty quick process. But Michael, before we talk about something extra, I would love for you, you've done so much, but tell me, what role has faith played for you in your life, the work of your hands? Tell me about that integration.
It's everything. I think the best way to say that, I heard this years ago. A girl tells her pastor, I'm so happy to tell you that I look at my life like a pie. And my life has always been a pie of my friends and travel and my career and my parents and my kids. And pastor, I'm so happy to let you know that there is now a slice that is my faith. So an aspect of my life is my faith. And the pastor looks at the girl and he said, well, Cindy, I look at my life like a pie too. And I have all those same exact aspects. But one of the slices is not my faith. She goes, what? How so? I would imagine that's the biggest slice. He said, no, it's the entire filling. Right? It's the entire filling. And it's exactly, that's exactly how I view how faith plays an integral role in every single aspect of my professional life, my personal life, my physical life, everything. I mean, it's the lens of everything that I see is how can I delight and glorify God in all that I do? You know, I just want to delight in him. I want to enjoy him all the days of my life. And I want to glorify him. I mean, he made us all for a unique purpose. A very, very, very unique purpose that when he knitted us together in our mother's womb, he said, this little child of mine is going to be made for something. And I believe that the four steps of our life is one is to know God. I believe that that's the first most important step. It's like for us to know who God is that made the heavens and the earth. Number two, I believe it's to find freedom. And to find freedom for me, I've been on that journey for many years. And it was deeply going into my childhood. I call it my little boy self. Right? It's figuring out what are those little boy insecurities that make you flare up at times, that is typically the root of your insecurities, right? So once you get through that, you could find freedom. Number three, it's to discover your purpose. And that is kind of where I believe that most people want and talk about, right? But they want to skip over the other two. But it's discovering your purpose. It's knowing that God has made you to either be a painter, or a CEO, or an engineer, or a mechanic, or a builder, or an artist, something. But like, figure out what your purpose is. And your purpose is always going to be the last one that's going to lead to making a difference, right? And so all of that to me is what life is. I know God now. I have found freedom through a lot of counseling, through a lot of therapy, through a lot of intensives that I've done. I figured out what my calling is in business and creating businesses and investing in businesses. And now all I want to focus on is making a difference in the lives of others.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That'll preach. That'll preach, Michael. Well, let me ask you, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
Two things I think is something extra that every leader needs. A spiritual director. That's a very tactical answer, but I believe that every true leader needs someone to come alongside them that's only focused on their emotional and spiritual being. I believe that it's just utterly critical. It's the common denominator of every single human out there is we are spiritual beings and we are highly emotional beings, yet we have no coaching and no support, almost little to none. And to me as a leader, that has been by far the game changer. I meet with my spiritual director every 2 weeks and it has been a game changer. That's the first thing. The second thing that I think every leader needs is a lot of solitude time. I think that we are just in a hectic world of just constant doing, responsiveness, email, text, phone calls. You just go, pick up your kids. And as leaders, we need time to always zoom out and to take an entire analysis of our lives, of our families, of our businesses. And that to me is by far the common denominator that you see from Steve Jobs and Warren Buffett and so many other leaders, right? They have margin to think, right? So unfortunately, I think that there's a huge deficit in that today.
Oh, that is so good. I could not agree with you more. I always say, I've got one of my spiritual mentors is Dr. Richard Blackaby. And he said, if you don't take that time, if you don't build that margin in, if you're 1 degree off, Michael, you're off. And 1 degree over time, you're going to end up in a totally different place than where you're intended to be, right? So, yeah, I could not agree with you more. Well, hey, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much today for being on the show. I know that our listeners are going to benefit so much from hearing from you and your wisdom and experience. And I just wish you the very, very best. God bless your business and your family. And I hope that we see each other in person again soon.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.